Welcome once again to the psychedelicparenting.org podcast. I am your host, Jonathan, and with me today is Connor. Connor and I have known each other for about a year, and something very cool happened recently that I wanted to share with everybody, and it harkens back to a question that was asked of me in March of this year when I spoke at symposia at UMass Amherst. A friend of ours asked us, I'm not a parent, but I am interested in sharing these experiences with my own parents. And how do I go about introducing them to these substances, these medicines? And this particular experience between Connor and I really spoke to that question, and I really wanted to have the opportunity to share it with you all. So, a while back, Connor and I were sitting in ceremony together, and Connor's dad was there. And Connor played guitar for everybody in the circle. It was amazing, beautiful. Everyone was sitting around. He was sitting in a chair, and everyone was sitting around kind of guru style around him, just listening enchantedly. And he finished his song, put his guitar away, and he went back to his mat, and he sat down next to his dad. And his dad embraced him, and I heard his dad whisper to him, "You bring me so much joy." And I was just overwhelmed with emotion, and I just thought, oh, I wish my dad was here right now. So I want to introduce Connor and ask him to tell us how he got to where that got to that experience, how his dad became interested in the medicine, and yeah, just kind of give us a background and tell us how things happen. And if you maybe want to start out telling us a little bit about yourself, go for it.
Thanks, Jonathan. So my dad and I have always had a pretty, I guess we're both pretty open-minded people when it comes to a lot of things. And so when I was probably, I think, you know, around maybe 20 or so, he and I had shared some experiences with cannabis, and you know, both he and I had previous experiences but never together, and so I guess that was the first time that we had really, you know, shared using these type of medicines together. And some years obviously passed, and you know, we had kind of became even more open about our other experiences that we had had independently. And so a while back, I had my first ceremony, and it was just truly incredible. And I told him that I was going. You know, I let him know what it was gonna, or what at least I knew of it, what it was gonna be like. And then after shared with him about, you know, what best that I could, shared what had kind of my experiences, the details as far as I could explain. And so, you know, immediately, really, I think after having those experiences, I truly just really wanted everybody that I knew to have them, sure, including my father. So, so right away, I just said, you know, you gotta try this out, you know. And he, you know, told me before that he had some really incredible experiences with LSD, and, you know, in the late 60s and stuff. So, in fact, he kind of explains them to be, you know, some of the most, you know, meaningful experiences that he's really ever had, you know, sure, certainly up on the top of the list.
Yeah.
And so I just thought, you know, this would be incredible to share with him, and that we would, you know, do this together. And so, some time passed, and, you know, it seemed, you know, as though he was a little bit avoiding it. And I think, you know, I'm sure he has his reasons, but, in any event, he and I were, together for his birthday. And, you know, I just asked him, I said, you know, would you like to experience DMT right now? And, you know, at the time, and still, I really haven't, I wouldn't say I'm anywhere close to an experienced or, you know, user of that. But I, at any rate, I asked him, you know, would you like to do this? And he said, sure. Okay. So, we gave it a go, and I journeyed first, and then he went, and, it was like immediately after he had that experience with DMT that, you know, he was just in absolute awe. And I think like most people are with that medicine. But right. Right after he said, I want to go to a ceremony. And I said, all right, well, there's one next month. So so we did. And it was just so incredible to have him there. And, you know, he's somebody that he's a very, very good man, and he's just given me so much. And, you know, I just love him tremendously. And interestingly, you know, almost every time that I had experienced a ceremony before, he would come up, you know, and I would think about him and how much that I love him and how much I just want to show him and tell him that I love him and just, you know, really express it more in our daily lives. And so we went together, and it was just incredible to have him next to me, you know, during that time. And it really, I think what occurred was what I had hoped would, you know, it really kind of broke down, between the two of us, any barriers for us to show the love that we have for each other. Mm-hmm. And so there were several times, and we were there for two nights. And so, you know, and each night there were several times where it was just, you know, just hugging him and just saying, Mitch, I love you so much, you know, just absolute pure form of expression, you know, just holding each other so tightly. And so, yeah, really thankful for having that experience. And, you know, after that, you know, and I think with this work, with the medicines is, you know, how do you integrate that into your life? And, you know, if you're finding truths about your being and your existence and, you know, through these experiences, you know, how do you integrate that into our, you know, this physical realm that we live in day to day? And so I think in a lot of ways from that experience together, we have established more openness. Mm-hmm. And I'm more comfortable just to approach him and just give him a hug, or when we're departing from each other, you know, to hug him and say I love you and things like that. So it was definitely very beneficial, I think, for our relationship, you know. Mm-hmm. Just heightened it and even made it even better than it was before. That doesn't mean that we don't, you know, butt heads sometimes. I mean, he's my dad, I'm his son, you know. Sometimes we can be hard-headed, but I also found too, actually, that when that does happen, I'm more able to apologize, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, you know, whatever it is, it just seems, you know, it's easy for me to just realize how, you know, it's just, we just don't have the time to be like that, you know, to argue or whatever. And so if it happens, a lot of times it's much easier for me to just say, hey, you know, I'm sorry, I was being an idiot, you know, or whatever. And then, and usually he's pretty good about, if he was to say saying the same thing. So, yeah. So a lot of tremendous benefits from having that experience with my dad during ceremony.
So how old is your dad?
My dad is 77.
And you said that he did have some experiences in his youth in the 60s, like many people of our parents' generation did.
Yeah. He wasn't a youth during then. You know, he was born in, I think, 34. So, yeah. He was in a mature adult, you know, when he'd first, you know, experienced LSD. And, well, he told me one of his favorite stories, you know. And he didn't experience many dreams with LSD, but one, I think maybe like three or four, I think he said, but, one was that, you know, he was alone and he was at a cabin and he had a little boat and, he went out on this boat and he was just out there alone. And, you know, he said the sun was like, you know, kind of close to setting, and he just, you know, he felt what, you know, kind of has been described by others, just as, you know, this absolute just oneness, you know, just a pureness of everything. And so he said it was funny because he didn't want it to end, you know. Mm-hmm. He was just in that space, he just felt so complete. And so that was always that I think always resonated with him, you know. And time, a lot of time had gone by since that experience. Mm-hmm. And so you know, so he was open to it, and he was open to hear about what I was doing, and you know, he was open to it, and you know, he went, and ultimately it was good. I think he's a very good and loving man, but not so, he doesn't really have a tremendous capacity to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he loves well, but if there's something going on, if, you know, it's hard for him to really share what's going on with his feelings and so forth.
Sure.
And so after we had the ceremony, you know, we have this sharing session, and he really wasn't, I don't think, able to disclose a lot. One thing that he said was, which I really appreciated and I think is really true, is that, you know, that he said words to explain his experience in words would just only kind of get in the way, that it was almost like it would kind of in some way reduce it to something not as powerful and meaningful. And
yeah.
I mean, I think that's very true. Yeah. You know, I don't think it's something that you really can explain in words. It's not an intellectual thing. It's something that is all, you know, heart and energy. And, and so, you know, I mean, I've said before, I think, you know, it's kind of like, you know, to kind of say it's like, you know, if somebody had never eaten an orange, you know, describing what an orange tastes like. I mean, you could go on about whatever, you know, the texture and the flavor and so forth, but you know, they would never really know unless they ate an orange.
Exactly.
So he just said, you know, he didn't really disclose a lot of anything of his emotions during the time. But I think ultimately it was a very, very good experience for him.
Yeah. There's a lot of wisdom in that. Terrence McKenna used to say that his experiences with the mushrooms were always very like centered in language experiences. So he had a lot of glossolalia, speaking in tongues kind of experiences. And, he often said that these experiences emanated from a place where like language comes from, but it's very difficult to sort of project language into that space. And the way that he characterized it, he said, these things are very difficult to English.
Well said.
Yeah. Yeah. And, your dad's probably kind of in like the sort of on the border between like the silent generation and the baby boomers. And, I think that name, the silent generation, says a lot about there's like this sort of inherent stoicism. And I one of the things that I've noticed is I think there's like over the years, over the generations, especially with like parenting, being a dad, there's been this like gradual softening of what it means to be a dad. Like my dad was softer with me, like more feminine, I guess you could say, more like expressing of like real emotions, and then his dad was with him.
Yeah.
And I think I am more open with my emotions and my you know, showing love to my son, even than my dad was with me. And it's just like we are learning as a culture how to be soft, how like men can be soft and show emotion.
Yeah.
And I think that these medicines have a lot to teach us in that realm.
Oh, I definitely agree. Yeah, I think, well, just with parenthood, although I'm not a parent myself, you know, I have had a lot of experience being with kids, and with my sisters and so forth, my nephews and all that. And so,
and you are in a committed relationship that
there's a child involved. Your girlfriend
has a 6-year-old beautiful daughter. And so, I think, you know, it's just, you know, I think maybe when parents really kind of, I wouldn't say fail, but kind of lose touch with their children is, you know, that they're not just being with them, you know. I mean, it's often that, you know, it's like, okay, you know, directing them to do this or that, which probably in all in good intent, but often miss just the experience of actually being with them and, you know, just hanging out, you know, and experiencing the relationship, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, to bring it back to the ceremony, I mean, that's exactly what that was. I mean, we were just in that experience together. And I think we have a really good relationship, and I think we are quite capable and often do experience each other and have a good time with each other. But in this ceremony, it was just all the barriers between the expression of love was just really just broken and gone, and all that was left was just that, just that connection of love, mm-hmm. between, you know, myself and my father.
So what recommendation would you give to someone who is interested in introducing a parent to these experiences, and like, so where do they start? What are the first things, like, how do you break the ice on this stuff?
Boy, that's a tough one. For me, in my experience, it was, as I'd mentioned, pretty, I guess easy. I mean, just because his mindset, just being open-minded, and, you know, that we'd already kind of had shared experiences and so forth. And there's so many variables to that. I mean, if, you know, the relationship and the strength of the relationship, the connection that is already there, you know, the love that's shared between, you know, the child and parent, is obviously huge. Mm-hmm. The openness that they're able to, you know, express, you know, their feelings and so forth. And I think all that has a huge piece. So, and I'm sure it's different, obviously, for everyone. I would hope, I mean, initiating the conversation, and depending on, you know, that openness, I guess my suggestion would just be, you know, at the beginning, I would just say how important that experience is for that person. Mm-hmm. I mean, just to say, you know, I mean,
how healing. So just being open with your family about your own experience.
Yeah. Yeah. But I also realize, you know, like there's a lot of, you know, parents out there that are not, you know, and, you know, I think if they're really kind of, you know, kind of close to that, I can't imagine it'd be tremendously easy.
Yeah.
I couldn't say really necessarily how the best way is. And I think there's so many, it's so, such a dynamic, you know, so many variables, and it's very complex, mm-hmm. being based on these relationships,
sure.
you know, I mean, but just coming from a place like this is an experience that I had. And I mean, it was, you know, the best that you can to explain how that was so healing and meaningful. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, hopefully they can hear that. And then from there, you know, just try to convince them to go.
Yeah. And Connor and I are lucky enough to reside in a state where we have legal marijuana for medical purposes. And I think now 38 states have either medical marijuana or outright recreational legal use of marijuana. So, and you saying that your relationship around plant medicines with your dad started with cannabis.
Yeah.
And so maybe a recommendation is to start there, start with cannabis.
Yeah, it could. Sure. I mean, now that I think it's becoming a quote unquote more mainstream, or certainly more acceptable, not seen as this, like, you know, this like bad drug, you know, maybe that would be a good way. You know, although, you know, certain people kind of, it depends on how they react to that. I mean, there's such a difference between those substances and these medicines that we can utilize. Maybe it would be good, but, you know, of course, if somebody, you know, the parent didn't have a good experience with the cannabis, that might make them shy away from thinking of trying anything else, mm-hmm. you know? So, I mean, it has such a kind of a different effect for different
sure.
people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All I can say is just, is openness coming from a place of love, expressing, you know, the best that you can of how meaningful and how powerful and healing it was for you, if that was your experience. And then, yeah, trying to convey that and telling them, I guess, you know, just how they want, how you, that child would want that for their parent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or not child, you know.
Yeah. And I think, too, this harkens back to this idea that we've talked about in a lot of these podcasts of radical honesty, of being just 100% open with the people that you care about like what motivates you and what moves you and what's important to you in your life. We as psychedelic people, I believe, have to be open about who we are, about what it is that makes us the way we are. I like to sometimes sort of talk about how in the very early years of Christianity, for example, there was this mass conversion across the Roman Empire. And this was in a time when Christianity was a persecuted minority religion. And so people weren't, you know, there wasn't televangelists, There weren't, you know, people doing camp revivals. People were hiding out in their homes, and they were having services in secret. And the reason why so many people converted in those first 100 years or so was because of the way that these people lived their lives. They gave up everything that they owned. They lived in these communal relationships. They cared for the poor. They went and ministered to people in prisons. And people recognized that. And people said, I recognize that you've changed as a human being. Tell me what it is you're doing. And I don't think that that has changed all that much in the last 2,000 years. I think that if we are proud of who we are, and we go out and we learn the lessons from sitting in the ceremonies, we purge the negativity from our lives, and we go out and we be people of community, people who care about the world, who care about each other, who show our emotions, just like you're saying, then we have this opportunity. People will say, I recognize that there's something different about you. What is it? I want what you have. And that's an in for us, especially with our families. You know,
and being open about everything then.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, it's scary because, you know, there's an article that I just posted to our Facebook page that was published by Cognitive Liberty UK. It's called The Religion That Has No Name, The Persecution of Psychedelic Spirituality. And this is really resonates a lot with the things that I've focused on recently, is that we have to really own this, as this is our spirituality. This is our religion. And, you know, a lot of times we don't like the words religion because it has a lot of negative connotations in our culture for people that are trying to be open-minded. But we can sort of take back those concepts and say, this is the most pure version of religion. This, like, touching, whether it's the higher self or the divine oneness, or however we want to refer to it, however we experience it. That's the sort of the root of religious experience, is these ecstatic states where we can touch the divine or touch the infinite. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have to sort of own it, and we have to be able to be strong enough to say, yes, there's some danger in coming out, but it's like Martin Ball said in our interview, it's like, if somebody doesn't come out there and say it, then the things will never change. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's great that, you know, I'm grateful to have you here, and grateful for the people that are, you know, stepping out and sort of sticking their neck out to some degree and saying, I want people to know what it is that moves me and what it is that's made me the person that I am, you know? So why don't you tell me a little bit about your relationship with your girlfriend's daughter, and how you feel like your medicine experiences have influenced that relationship?
Well, she's just an incredible little human being. I mean, she's just a tremendous, just great, great ball of energy, you know. And so with my experiences with ceremonies, I have, it seems almost, you know, every experience I come back to at certain times during that experience, I come back to thinking of the people in my life and how much I love them and how appreciative I am for having them in my life. Mm-hmm. Appreciative of who I am, appreciative of all the relationships that I have. Also, you know, I think too about how to improve them, and, you know, maybe some of my faults, and, you know, realizing those things. So one of the things that when I did think of her during my experience was just to say to her that, just to say, you know, that I really enjoy you. You know what I mean? Like, I just, you know, like, I love you, but I just enjoy you so much as a human being. Like, I'm just so happy that you and I are together and that we get to hang out all the time, you know? And, you know, she's like, oh yeah, cool. Me too, you know? But, you know, that was something that I just thought, oh, I think it would be really nice to say that, you know, that would be just to share that with her, just, you know. And she definitely heard it, you know, but it was nice to do that. And in other respects, yeah, I think it comes back to what I was saying earlier. It's just to be with her, you know, hang out, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it is, you know, we're going to do it together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we're going to make a decision to do something or, you know, then we make that decision kind of, you know, together. And, you know, of course there's the, you know, the, that, you know, you're the adult in the situation. So, you know, there are some things I'm going to need you to do this or that, you right. know, but that just, that being, I think that her seeing me as somebody who loves her and is somebody who is with her and experiences life together, it creates a nice flow to our whole relationship, you know? And it's great. And, you know, yeah. So yeah, during these experiences, I had reflected on that. And I think that that has kind of manifested in our relationship in really positive ways with, and it's, again, is this, you know, is this like, it's the love, you know, it's like that, like, I want to love well, I want to be well, I want to know, I want the people in my life to know that I love them and I want to be with them. And I think Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, said the most precious gift that you can give somebody is your presence mm-hmm. and just, you know, being with them. And so that's really what I take with it. And I try to do as best I can with everybody in my life, though I, you know, I get stressed out like yeah. anybody, you know, whatever, but yeah, I always remind myself of that, those truths. And that's certainly there with my good little friend. Yeah, right.
I definitely agree about like presence. It's a big challenge in our world today. We all have these little computers that are constantly drawing our attention away from the things and the people around us. I saw a really funny picture on Facebook, speaking of being drawn away from the people around us, but I saw this really funny picture on Facebook and it was like written on like an A-frame chalkboard, like in the front of a restaurant. And it said, are you going to be staring at your phone in any interesting places this weekend? Yeah. And, you know, I struggle with, you know, staring at my phone too often. It's a big thing for me. And I see my son picking up those same patterns, you know. I, even when I was young, I did things like played my Game Boy a lot. And so I come from, like, you know, I had a computer from when I was 6 years old. My parents bought us an Apple II, so I'm a computer kid. But you know, I think that there's a different. We're taking it to a different level now that we all have our own little computer, and the internet can answer all of our questions. And there's a great value in that. You know, Terrence really thought there was going to be this big positive thing from the internet, and you know, he died before Facebook, before Second Life, before, you know, any of the real big social media things came about. But he saw that there was a lot of potential for communication. And I think that we can utilize these tools in good ways to build community. But I personally think that real community is the most important thing that we can do. So like today, Connor came to my house and he helped me tear apart an old deck that I had. And I'm really grateful that you did that. And that's real community. Like, how do we help each other out? How do we, you know, do you babysit for your friend's kid so that they can have a date night? Do you help somebody care for an aging parent? That's like real community. And, you know, one of the things that you do that I have a lot of respect for is that you're helping to rebuild community as for a career. And I have a lot of respect for that. I know that you have a lot of frustrations in terms of how you're impacting the world, but I think that there's a lot of potential in what you're doing, and I think it's awesome. Do you want to talk a little bit about your mom?
Sure. So I guess it's a kind of a background. My mother has had a pretty difficult life. I mean, since she was a very young child, you know, she experienced a lot of abuse in her home, and her mother was just very not well. She was, I think, very, very much damaged from that. I think miraculously, though, I've always really appreciated about her is that she was really, when I was young and I was a kid, and even now, but of course, you know, she would nurture me when I was, you know, I felt very safe and well. My mom loved me very thoroughly when I was, you know, young and still does. And, you know, time went by for her. And, you know, when I was, you know, about, I think I was in around like fifth grade or so, and, you know, she experienced a breakdown, and she's gone through a lot of really hard work, you know, mm-hmm. trying to figure a lot of things out and find peace. And so, you know, she's been troubled, mm-hmm. and our relationship has kind of gone, you know, ups and downs. You know, it's difficult for me at certain points, you know, to see her really not being able to be like self-sufficient and things like that. And so, you know, I want to see her to be like, and for a long time, I just really just wish that she was like, I guess, quote unquote, like normal, mm-hmm. or like, I guess a little like, more palatable brand of crazy. But, she's a good woman, and she's gone through a lot of pain. She did a lot of work to try to heal. And you know, sometimes nowadays, sometimes our relationship is a little bit better than others. You know, what's actually really interesting is that she has not come up, and I've gone to, I think now about 11 ceremonies, and she hasn't come up. And I don't know if that is because I have kind of moved on from like an attachment of like the attachment of her, me wanting to her to be well, or like, you know, mm-hmm. if I've actually, and I've gone through therapy and bioenergetic therapy, and I have incredible therapists that I still see now. Mm-hmm. And so I've worked through a lot of that, like a lot of the things with my mother. And so sometimes I think, well, have I kind of worked through it all, or is it so kind of buried deep down there that even through the experiences I haven't brought her into attention. And you know, I haven't made it my intention to, mm-hmm. so perhaps maybe I ought to. Maybe I'm a little afraid of that. I don't know. You know, at this point now, you know, she's struggling, and you know, we're there, my sister and I help out a lot, and she has her good, better days than others, mm-hmm. and you know, you try to get that good time in and really appreciate that, and then you know, the reflecting on that can help you kind of go through some of the more like, you know, more not sticky times, you know. So
reflecting on this idea about, you know, in traditional cultures, especially shamanic cultures, have a very different like worldview or cosmovision when it comes to mental illness. It's often been said that a prerequisite for being a shaman is having had some kind of psychological break or psychological illness, and that by seeking out healing and healing oneself, that the shaman gains the power to heal others. And I've reflected on this a lot. There's been mental illness in my family as well. And I have reflected on this of like, how do we as a culture look at mental illness? We look at it as something that needs to be changed or suppressed, or this person, especially people that have like psychotic episodes or that are schizophrenic, there's like this idea of like, this person isn't well, they're seeing things that aren't there. In shamanic societies, it's seen as like, oh, this person is having this, you know, is having this expression of like seeing into the other worlds. And so they approach it very differently. Instead of it seeing as like a weakness or something that needs to be suppressed or put away in a home, they see it as, this is a person expressing their sort of innate healing abilities or innate ability to cross over into the other world. And, you know, having reflected on being in life with a person with mental illness, I mean, how do you see that in terms of like the way that you've seen your mom be sort of treated by the system?
Well, I think that it's, you know, pretty obvious when you look at just the way our society treats people with mental illness and the safety nets that we have for them, and, you know, the institutions and facilities that we have available for folks that are, going through those issues. You know, and from my experience, you know, it is, if my mom, for example, had Parkinson's or something like mm-hmm. that, you know, it would be, I think, easier to be compassionate mm-hmm. Than I am, and I try to be as much as I can be with her, and especially when she's going through some tougher times, mm-hmm. you know. I think the thing is with the, you know, when the mind isn't gone, it's not as easy to see and easy to accept, and especially when, you know, when people become, they direct the negative energy towards you.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, you know, I can handle this only so much. And even, you know, even the deepest, you know, and the most connected of relationships, it's just when that happens, it is like really, really powerfully difficult, you know. And, you know, somebody who's, you know, physically ill and they, you know, need some help, you help them, you know, but they're there to say thank you or whatever. And, you know, with a mental illness, you know, it can be abusive, or, you know, or if not abusive, it can just be really, really heavy, you know. And you mean you walk away after and it's just like just drained, or, mm-hmm. you know, or just feeling like in this dark cloud. And so it takes, I think, a really deep peace within. I mean, really, to, I think, be able to accept and really be able to be nurturing to somebody who has mental illness, who's, you know, experiencing some kind of an episode where they're being really negative and all these things, you know. And that peace, you know, is not, you know, easy to call up, you know, every when these things are happening, you know. And even if it's somebody that you really love, you know, and you recognize and you know, like, oh, this is an illness. I mean, I think to reflect back to say, you know, this is an illness, I mean, that's something that definitely, I think, you know, for me helps. It's just, you know, when things are not good with my mom, it's like I have to say to myself, like, this is an illness, mm-hmm. you know. And my mom is, I should say, she's not like schizophrenic, it's, you know, she's not, you know, but she's, you know, gone through quite a lot, and, you know, she's on pharmaceuticals, and, you know, there's that whole kind of component.
Yeah, well, many of us are these days, so
yeah. And so, you know, I think it takes society at large to be able to say, you know, to really fully recognize this is an illness, this is something real, this mm-hmm. is something that, you know, mm-hmm. That these people live with. And also, and then the compassion component, that, you know, to be in these states of mind, you know, fear, scare, you know, anger, you know, just this utter confusion is just awful. I mean, the experience of that, and I guess, you know, I haven't lived with that, but through my ceremonies, I've certainly been in places where it was like madness, you know. I felt just completely nothing to hold on to, just, you know. And so relating that to my mom, I guess, in this case, mm-hmm. and my experience with that, it's just, God, it's got to be so awful for her, you know, in there. So like that helps to bring in the compassion component, then that kind of then can help to manifest the patience, mm-hmm. and but nevertheless, you know, it's difficult. So, you know, for the society to be more helpful and more like healing and really kind of look out for folks that are in that space, I mean, I think it takes really kind of like almost the individuals in society to have patience and compassion,
yeah,
and, you know, the insight to see it as an illness, and that these people are in pain, and yeah. they need help.
Right on. So I'd like to ask you one more thing before we sign off. Since you are, you do work professionally in community building and sort of lifting up troubled neighborhoods, I'd like to ask you, what do you think is the best sort of first step for people that sort of feel like they're alone in their practice, or maybe they do have a group of people that they practice with occasionally with sacred medicines? How should they go about building real community together?
Yeah, that's a big one. You know, people need, I think, really to first realize that we're all in this together. You know, Alan Watts said, the meaning of life is just to live. And it's so plain and so obvious, and yet everybody just runs around in this great panic trying to achieve something outside of themselves. And I'll tell you that this is probably the most difficult part of building community and, you know, kind of revitalizing things, is that the system is really flawed. You know, people are, we have this just ambition running through all of us, you know, and we've got to, you know, achieve all these things. And, you know, if somebody gets something, then that means I can't get something. And that whole, that the way that snowball runs down the hill is just really just destructive. I mean, and like I said before, it's like, you know, it comes down to, if you have a healthy society, is the components of a healthy society are healthy individuals of that society.
Sure.
I mean, peaceful people, yes. You know, people that don't need to achieve all these things outside of themselves. You know, and so I think, you know, you find catalysts in community. You find people who are willing to go, you know, the extra, you know, foot, inch, whatever, mile. Mm-hmm. And then you use them to help to inspire others that are around them. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not like you just, you know, go into a community and say, hey, everybody, let's go out and do this. You know, it's really, I mean, you know, part of it is that a little bit, but, you know, it's finding, okay, who are folks around here who believe in community? Mm-hmm. Who are the like-minded folks that we can work with, and then utilize them to then branch out to the folks that they know that mm-hmm. we can get them on board, you know? And
so it's about personal connections.
Yeah, it's totally. I mean, it, you know, networking. Yeah, and but you know, connecting with people who want to do this, and then kind of leveraging that that energy to then, you know, trickle down to the other folks, and then, you know, start making things happen. You know, do service project, or, you know, show people, hey, you know, we did this. You know, we did this, and we can do more. And the more people that we have on board, the more and better and greater things that we can do. In places that are, you know, really disadvantaged, you know, they've gone through so much hardship, and, you know, it's, you know, sometimes you see they're just, okay, sure, you know, like they've lost hope, you know, they don't see anything good happening. And so, you know, getting the ball rolling is the major hurdle. Once the ball is rolling, then, you know, you kind of keep getting people on, you know, and
people get excited when they see that something's changing. You can talk and talk.
Yeah.
Right, especially in some place like Detroit, where things have been so difficult, it's hard to get things that make an indentation that makes people say, "Yeah, there is something going on here that I should get involved in."
Yeah, and that if we do, there will actually be an outcome that's positive. You know, yeah, I mean, and you know, when people start feeling that the good feeling that they're accomplishing something that means something, or helping somebody out, and they feel that reward of just simply helping somebody, you know, I think that's a, you know, it's a powerful thing. So, but it, you know, it's not always easy. Yeah. You just gotta, you know, you keep going, and, you know, just, as I said, you know, work with the people who want to make the change, and then, you know, try to get as many people on board to follow suit. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that we can reach out to each other. That's what we're trying to do with this podcast, with our website. You know, there's a lot of things popping up on Facebook. Like I see people in the psychedelic community trying to build connections. Tons of different things on Facebook keep popping up. Many this year, just this year alone, I've seen, you know, 20 different invites to like building psychedelic community, whether it's around sacred mushrooms, around ayahuasca, around DMT. There are places to reach out to one another on social media. And then what we have to do is, you know, find those people that are really interested in building something substantial, something concrete. There was a really interesting article that came by across my desk this week about how like festival culture needs to change. And it's something that I've thought about a lot. I went to Burning Man last year, and one of the things that struck me about it was that there was this amazing culture at Burning Man, this culture of gifting, of everything. You go to Burning Man, and once you're there, you don't spend money. There's nobody's selling anything. People are giving things away. And the problem I see with that is that, you know, people spend, you know, millions of dollars on Burning Man every year, like collectively. And speaking of Detroit, one of the things that I felt was that if we took all the money that people spent on Burning Man every year to go out to the Black Rock Desert and assemble this city, if that was spent on some place like Detroit or, you know, any other like struggling city in America, struggling to redefine itself in this sort of post-industrial world, what could we as a community accomplish? Like, could you create something lasting? If you could, you like create a place where people didn't deal in money, a whole like a society that was permanent, you know, that would could really at least make a serious impact in terms of revitalizing a crumbling city. If people took that money and just did something permanent, mm-hmm. you know, is that a realistic idea?
Well, there's a lot of money that's being spent for revitalization in Detroit. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we're hundreds of millions of dollars a yeah. year from many different foundations, mm-hmm. you know, funneling that to all sorts of nonprofit, quasi-nonprofit, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's really, really on how and what's done with the money yeah. and how are you going to make real systematic change?
Right, because there's no jobs.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, it's if you have a place without, you know, there's no real adequate education, you know, no workforce development, yeah. you know, jobs that really, you know, aren't available, you know, that's the systematic, right. that's the systemic issues, right? Yes. And so, I mean, you know, all kinds of things are happening. They're good. A lot, most of them, you know, and certainly they're all well intended. You know, the intention is good for all these, you know, but you know, how, to what extent do they really impact systemic change? You know, something yeah. that's sustainable. So, yeah, and just in the specific case of Detroit, or you know, just I guess in any real, you know, in poverty, we're talking about yeah. poverty or you know, inequity in this country. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you know, it comes down to it's. Education, you know, what do people, you know, these programs, safety nets for folks that make sure that they have the tools to function in this society. Mm-hmm. I mean, without that, you know, you're just putting a band-aid on things. So, you know, you, with work that I've seen in Detroit, a lot of it's good, certainly well-intended. Is it changing? Like, I mean, maybe it is, but is it changing for the long term?
Yeah.
And, you know, it comes down to the mechanics of, you know, the way this whole, you know, this whole country and Western society operates, you know, so, but,
so we have to rethink what we mean when we say, you know, like an economy, for example, like if we can't supply, bring jobs to a community like that, we have to redefine economy. We have to redefine, you know, the food supply. We have to redefine what it means to work, right?
Yeah. yeah.
Because people are working. I mean, people are doing things every single day, whether it's building a garden in a empty lot, or whether it's selling drugs on a corner. I mean, that stuff is work. And I think that we have to like rethink what work is in the community and what's of value to people and how, you know, specifically for the psychedelic community, how do we impact positive change? Because people talk about these substances being transformative.
It's education. It's funny because I guess I haven't thought about it. These ideas related, I mean, with community building related to moving forward the psychedelic movement, people are afraid of what they don't know. You know, and if they don't have the adequate information, if they don't know people who can tell them the truth that these are really important, incredible tools for human beings to find some deeper understanding of our existence. I think the more that they're exposed, the more that they get the correct information, the more that they can rationally look at what the drugs are in our society, alcohol and, yes. and all these different, you know, terrible substances. But as it relates to what I was saying about earlier with this community building, is you find the people, you know, such as yourself, right? I mean, these kind of trailblazers, so to speak, you know, who are willing to stick their neck out and say, all right, you know, I'll put my face on this because I believe in it that much, mm-hmm. you know? And, you know, then you know, you find, you know, these people through your, even in your community or whatever, in your network, you know, and ask, make the ask, you know, mm-hmm. that's what we do in community development. You got to go out and ask people, hey, I noticed you were mowing your neighbor's lawn. Would you be willing to like help us with this big scale, volunteer service day that we're going to do, mm-hmm. you know, we're gonna get 100 people out or whatever, you know? So it's, you make the ask and say, I see that you're, that you believe in this. Mm-hmm. What would you think about, you know, doing this or that, you know, or, and then you, you know, so you build that capacity of this network mm-hmm. and then they go, you know, then they ask, will you be a part of, you know, can yeah. you, what, I mean, I, you know, even if it's something, you know, something small, can you, would you be willing to do this? Like I'm here with you right now. We're having this conversation, which is great. I think that's a, that, that's building something.
I agree.
So you can ask me maybe sometime, wait, would you mind doing something else or what, you know, yeah. And would you be comfortable exposing yourself to this extent because mm-hmm. it would help us with this or that, you know, so make the ask and say, you know, let's move this thing.
And even just finding out who there is in your sort of physical community who may be already turned on to these substances or ready to be turned on to these substances. I mean, you know, if you're, for example, if you're a parent and you're, you know, with your kid, you know, waiting for the for school to start in the morning and there's parents that you see every day. And, you know, one of them, we've seen them wear a Grateful Dead shirt a couple of times, or, you know, they have a peace sign on the back of their car and you're like, you know, maybe we have some things in common and you just sort of, you know, touch, put your foot in the water and find out who these people are. And I think that we'll find out that there's a lot more of us than we think there is.
Yeah. I mean, the truth is that these are incredible substances. I mean, they're good. They're yes. healthy. They're not dangerous. You know, people need to know it.
Then the only danger is that you will start to understand that there's a lot of bullshit in society that isn't worth dealing with.
The powers that be may not see it as, you know, in the same light as we do, or right. you know, but the power that be are made up of, you know, human beings and people who get into political office if they've had these experiences before, you know, and just as this, you know, we're talking about cannabis and, you know, the legalization of cannabis is from recreational use and, you yeah. know, that's moving. And I mean, you know, that's an indicator. It's that this is it's a more open society when we, you know, the baby boomers now are, you know, coming through. And when you see these kind of indicators where it's like, wow, you know, people are open to this. I mean, it indicates an openness, I guess.
Yeah.
At the bottom.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, a mutual friend of ours was talking, he and I, and we were talking about this idea, this sort of old, you know, you're about the same age as I am in terms of like going through the DARE program as a kid or whatever. And they always used to say that like marijuana is the gateway drug. And so our mutual friend and I were sort of had this insight about, well, like cannabis is becoming the gateway substance for all these other things. Like as society becomes more accepting of cannabis and more people are comfortable with it as a state of being, then it makes it a little bit easier for us to have conversations about ayahuasca or about mushrooms.
Yeah. In your example, it's a gateway to positive substances.
Exactly.
Right. And where before, you know, they're talking about gateway to all these really destructive substances.
Yeah. Well, what I mean by gateway is, I mean, like, it's a gateway for the culture to accept these other things. Like, as the culture is accepting of cannabis, it's easier for us to have conversations with people about, say, ayahuasca.
Yeah. Definitely.
So on that, I would like to thank my friend Connor for being here today and continue to stick around with us at psychedelicparenting.org. As promised, we are implementing our forum capabilities to the website, but continue to leave comments. Continue to, you know, like us on Facebook and let us know what you would like to add. This conversation is open. So if there's anybody out there who has a great story that they want to tell, please give us an email. Let us know that you have a story because we want to share more and more of these stories about how these psychedelic substances, be it mushrooms, DMT, ayahuasca, are changing your life, are impacting your family, are making the world a better place. So please come share. We appreciate that you listen. And thank you again, Connor, for being a part of the conversation.
Thanks, Jonathan. Happy to be here.
All right. Thank you.